So let us turn to the book of Acts then. And we have been studying for months and months and months. Back here, I usually try to make a note, see if I did. When we actually started this book, as a matter of fact, was in... Oh, what have I got? Must have been October of 2012. So,
October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, and August now. We are 11 months into the book and finishing then this 28th chapter in the book itself this morning.
Acts chapter 28, much like 27 we studied last week, is principally just a historical record of the circumstances that are befalling Paul. We are going to see a little bit of a doctrinal statement there, if you will, or information toward the end. But we have come to the end of this grand book of history in the New Testament. It is the only book of pure history, if you will, in the New Testament. Though the Gospels, of course, have a great deal about the life of Christ, their purpose, you know, is very different. And so in the Acts of the Apostles, we have been seeing that the men whom Jesus selected to be the original 12, as well as Paul, the apostle who was born out of time or out of season, fulfilling the great commission that they had been charged with, to go into all the world and to preach the gospel. They have, at this point in time now, as we come to the end of the book of Acts, been fulfilling that responsibility for just at 30 years. You know that our calendars today don't really quite match properly, and that Jesus, according to our calendar, would have actually been born about 5 B.C. or 4 B.C., somewhere in there, so that his death and burial and resurrection would have taken place in about or right at 30 A.D. And we are come now to October or maybe early November of 61 A.D. So it's been just exactly 30 years that the gospel has been preached by these men. And we have seen that it has gone into Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the remotest parts of the land of Israel. And thence, as Paul begins his great journey, northerly up the coast outside the territory of Israel itself to Antioch of Syria, from which each of his journeys begins, all four of them. And then he has preached extensively throughout the territory that we know today as Turkey. He has established dozens, if not hundreds, of congregations in the course of his preaching. And Paul has become then the best example, certainly historically the most extensive information is given to us about how the gospel is to be preached. And after such enormous success in his freedom, he's been arrested, he's been under house arrest, I guess is the term we like the best, for 2+ years, 2.5 years in Israel, principally in the city of Caesarea Maritima. Been through this terrible voyage and the disastrous shipwreck last week in Acts chapter 27, and finds himself now on a little island called Malta, from which he will be making the last little bit of his journeyings to Rome itself for a trial about which we will not be told. The book will come to an end here in a few minutes, as we all well know, with Paul under that house arrest in rented quarters in Rome waiting for a trial before Nero, whom we all know is the great madman ruler of the Roman Empire. It is late in 61 A.D. Rome is going to burn 3 years from now, and Nero will blame it on the Christians. The first persecution of Christians that is authorized, instigated, and perpetrated by the Roman Empire is only 3 years away. Nero himself is only 7 years from his death, and it may be, it looks likely, that Paul is also only 7 years away from his. It is quite likely that both Paul and Nero will perish, Paul at Nero's hands, Nero by his own, a suicide, when he sees that he has lost the kingdom, or the Roman Empire, can't get it back. So when the book of Acts closes, about November of 61 A.D., and we are effectively, though we're told he spends 2 years there, in this time frame, things are really, really coming to a head for the Christians of the first century. In this, the first generation, they have seen everything. They have seen phenomenal success from the 3,000 who responded to the gospel the very first time the opportunity is ever offered, to the rising persecutions of the Jews, passing through various threats and imprisonment and beatings until the death of Stephen and others. James has perished in chapter 12. We've seen the escalating opposition that the Jews have offered. And then, as this book closes, we don't even know yet, you know, that very shortly there will be Roman persecution as well. As the book comes to a close, we are seeing the great triumph of Christianity over everything that could be thrown against it, and in a very short time, going into every corner of the entire Roman Empire. It is a phenomenal story and unparalleled, really, in human history. The last chapter of that story, and the conclusion then of the 30 years of the history of the book of Acts, sounds like this in chapter 28 and verse 1. When they've been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. And the natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. And when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, "Undoubtedly, this man is a murderer, and though he has been saved from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." However, he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. But they were expecting that he was about to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had waited a long time and had seen nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and began to say that he was of God. Now, in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us courteously 3 days. And it came about that the father of Publius was lying afflicted with fever and dysentery, and Paul went into him, and after he had prayed, he laid his hands on him and healed him. And after this had happened, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. They also honored us with many marks of respect. And when we were setting sail, they supplied us with all we needed. And at the end of 3 months, we set sail on an Alexandrian ship which had wintered at the island and which had the twin brothers for its figurehead. And after we put in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. From there, we sailed around and arrived at Rhegium, and a day later a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Puteoli. There we found brethren and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and thus we came to Rome. The brethren, when they heard about us, came from there as far as the market of Appius and the three inns to meet us, and when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. Now, pardon me 1 second. And verse 16, "And when we entered Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who was guarding him. And it happened that after 3 days, he called together those who were the leading men of the Jews, and when they had come together, he began saying to them, 'Brethren, though I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they had examined me, they were willing to release me because there was no ground for putting me to death. But when the Jews objected, I was forced to appeal to Caesar, not that I had any accusation against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I requested to see you and to speak with you, for I am wearing this chain for the sake of the hope of Israel.' And they said to him, 'We have neither received letters from Judea concerning you, nor have any of the brethren come here and reported or spoken anything bad about you. But we desire to hear from you what your views are. For concerning this sect, It is known to us that it is spoken against everywhere. And when they had set a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in large numbers. And he was explaining to them by solemnly testifying about the kingdom of God and trying to persuade them concerning Jesus from both the law of Moses and from the prophets from morning until evening. And some were being persuaded by the things spoken, but others would not believe. And when they did not agree with one another, they began leaving after Paul had spoken one word. The Holy Spirit rightly spoke through Isaiah the prophet to your fathers, saying, go to this people and say, you will keep on hearing, but will not understand. And you will keep on singing, but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear, and they've closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I should heal them. Let it be known to you, therefore, that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will also listen. When he had spoken these words, the Jews departed, having a great dispute among themselves. And he stayed 2 full years in his own rented quarters and was welcoming all who came to him, preaching the kingdom of God and teaching concerning the Lord Jesus Christ with all openness unhindered. Now, before we can go back and look, you know, line by line, make certain, brethren, that you grab a pencil or a pen there and write at the bottom, after verse 31, right at the end, that it is at this point and during these 2 years now, from 61 to 63, that Paul will write what is known as the prison epistles. Who can tell me what the prison epistles are? Give me one. Set.
Galatians.
Nope. Sorry. Paul's already written the Galatian letter. It's one of the first letters that he wrote. 4 epistles we call the prison epistles.
Ephesians.
Colossians. Philippians and Philemon. See, that's right. And it is hard to remember, so, you know, fear not. You think of it, it's not a big deal by any means. But be sure you write that down at the end there. The 4 prison epistles are Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. And then make a note, what is almost universally accepted is just 62 A.D. So it's late 61, wrote in 62, could have been 63, but you know, almost universally you'll find everybody say it's 62 A.D. is the date that that's generally used. So, in 62 A.D., 32 years then after Jesus rose from the dead, we get these 3 classic epistles, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. 3 are written to churches, Ephesus, Philippi, and Colossae. 1 is written to an individual, Philemon, about his slave, Onesimus, who had run away and apparently then been converted by Paul and now has become a helper to Paul, and Paul is returning him with the letter, giving instruction to his master, who is also a Christian, you know, on how he ought to treat him. And so you have then a great deal of insight about Paul and his attitude, you know, when you read Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon, knowing that he is writing them from this house arrest and in his own rented quarters there in Rome while he waits his trial. Now, again, before we get to the verses themselves, because with the long introduction now, I've got to change things a little bit. I want to make sure we got the whole text first, and then we'll see how much time we can spend on each verse now. But, you know, recognize then that Paul is writing these epistles from the same place at the same time and to the same region mostly. Ephesians and Colossians are geographically very, very close to each other. And so as you're reading those epistles, take note that especially in chapters 5 and 6 in Ephesians, and then in chapter 3 with the Colossian letter, Paul is using the exact same outline, even. He's addressing the same people in the same order, you know, and giving instructions to each of these different groups. And so you're learning about Paul and his attitude as you read those epistles since they're written at that time, and you're seeing what are some of his hopes and expectations for the people of that time. Now, Paul was very certainly acquitted at this first trial. So come 62 or 63 AD, Nero turns him loose. At that point, a tremendous amount of speculation begins. As we're looking at these various epistles that we just mentioned and others, particularly 2 Timothy, and we're trying to gather, you know, what did Paul do then in the period of time of 5 years from 63 to 68 when Nero did finally, and on the second trial, put him to death. And I've always hated, you know, really getting into that material because we have these statements in these various places that can be put together in different ways. So, you know he went to this city, that city, or another city, but you don't know, you know, in what order. And so, we don't even know quite for sure how many years that he was involved in it. And so, the only thing I want to just say this morning is that God was gracious and allowed him, as had been prophesied, to speak to every layer of society on earth. He had spoken to the poorest of the poor. He had spoken to the leaders and the wealthier, you know, influence brokers among the Jews. He had had great influence among Romans as well. Quite a few soldiers spent some time with him at length and impressed them greatly, you know, with prison escapes and all kinds of stuff going on. And so then, you know, he works through the government where Paul is addressing governors, two of them, you know, in Caesarea Maritima, and finally finds himself testifying before the emperor himself. Paul did it all. And as a result, suffered more grievously than anybody else. And we'll write to the Corinthians, lengthy list, you know, of how many things that he had endured. But that man was absolutely undaunted. And so, even if you're standing in front of a madman murderer, you know, Nero, whether you're standing there, you know, before the, I always think of them as slavering when we hear about them gnashing their teeth and that sort of thing, you know, the Jews before them, Paul just absolutely never took a step backward. So what we find in chapter 28 is just this conquest of all fear, this magnificent, you know, success of a man who just was courageous beyond all knowing. He was going to preach the gospel absolutely no matter what. So, that being the case, don't know exactly where he went. He had, though, apparently 5 more years after the book closes. This last chapter, though, begins with him on the island of Malta. Some of your translations will have Melita. There are different spellings both in the ancient literature and in some of your translations there. It's absolutely the same island. This island that has a tradition, of course, so strong about Paul's presence there that one bay is actually called St. Paul's Bay, you know, where you can go and perhaps, you know, would be the very place where Paul and 275 others came ashore so spectacularly as we saw in chapter 27. It is a place, by the way, where two seas meet. And so you have the construction on the shoreline there where, you know, you have that effect of that wedging water, you know, and all the rest. So, in verse 2, though, the natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. Now, brethren, think about a bonfire big enough to warm 276 people, see, and then however many of the locals that are distributing food and bringing clothing and blankets, you know, trying to help these people. It is cold, it is raining, it has been for the longest time. These men have only one meal, you know, to their name in the last 2 weeks, and they are, you know, as weak as you possibly can imagine. And so the scene in my mind is that the natives have done the great majority of the work, knowing where their own wood piles were, knowing where, you know, to find all that wood.
And so I think it is probably a mistake if you have a picture in your mind of Paul wandering off into the darkness somewhere to go find firewood. That was it at all. What I would do if I was doing this, I think, is I would take these utterly exhausted, bedraggled, freezing, soaked to the skin, just went through a swim, shipwrecked sailors, and I'd leave them at the fire. I can imagine, though, that it takes a lot of wood for 276 people. So that firewood would have been brought to the site all around that fire. And in the rain, thanks to the fire, being kept drier in preparation for simply being tossed onto the flame. So that what happened was, Paul went to some little pile over here, scooped it up, and had what in it? A snake in it. And then that snake was already fairly warm. That snake was already in dry firewood. That snake was already in proximity to the flames, but it was hiding. And then when Paul picks it up, goes to throw it into the flame, well, now we're right, in the flame, then that snake somehow comes leaping back out or clung to him, as it went in, not sure at all. But it's just this in verse 3, when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire. I think it just means gathered into his arms, not gathered a quarter mile away in the darkness. A viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, undoubtedly, this man is a murderer, and though he has been saved from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. However, he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. So, what do we have? We have people who are really desperate to try to say that it's all a pack of lies and never happened and nobody should be a Christian. And it's just truly astonishing. First they say, well, have you ever been to Malta? This is barren rock. There's no wood on that rock. And here this says, we're down in firewood, 276 people. Anybody see there's no wood on that island? Well, Brendan, there's no wood on that island what? 2,000 years later? Have you not heard of how many countries have denuded, their territory because they have been taking all the firewood away, until it comes to nothing? That's not nearly as powerful as an argument as, there's no poisonous snakes on Malta today. Well, brethren, as I understand it, you Hawaiian natives, you can correct me on this, but as I understand it, I don't think there are any snakes at all on Hawaii either. Why? Because thanks to somebody starting up a business and then losing their critters, what got loose and just took over the Hawaiian Islands? Mongoose. What does the mongoose eat? Snakes. What do you not have in Hawaii? Snakes. Because the mongoose ate them all up. So, this conclusively proves there were never any snakes on Hawaii, right? No. So, you see this amazing desperation to try and deny what happened. Then they say, the vipers that were known at the time, in Italy, which is not all that far away, that would not cling to your hand. They would bite and release. Okay. So what has that got to do any better than, the wood or the presence of snakes today to say that there wasn't one there that did that this time? Just nothing. And so, brothers, they were known to have poisonous snakes. They were known to have this kind of a snake that would cause you instantly or very shortly later to swell up and or to just fall over dead because it was an extremely fast-acting poison. And the physicians of the time, and by the way, remembering Luke is one, and he's writing about this event right here, the physicians of the time were very familiar with snake bite and what various antivenoms, that they had available at that time because it was a common problem at that time in the Roman Empire. These people are looking at a snake that they know causes death with such certainty that the uninspired literature says there's no antidote for this. Now, for some snake bites, there was. But for this one, there wasn't. And they take note of the fact that, partly and even principally, it's because this poison is so fast-acting that you can't even get a medicine and apply a medicine or make an attempt, you know, to put some kind of poultice or something on there, you know, or whatever they were using. You just can't even try. They die too fast. So these people know what they're talking about. They're familiar with this thing. They've seen this creature, and they have an explanation for it. And by the way, in Job's day, in the book of Job, if you have bad problems in your life, what did his friends think that proved? You had to be a sinner. Okay? Now, these people, we learn again from the uninspired sources, not only believe this same idea, it's very common throughout the Roman Empire, it's not just a Jewish idea, but they have taken it a step further that you will be punished in the part of your body with which you committed the crime. So, when these people, we learn from the uninspired sources, look down and they see that the snake is fastened on Paul's hand, and that it's this kind of snake, so the penalty is death, in their mythology and thinking, this means he must have committed a murder with that hand. That's how they view these circumstances. So they said, undoubtedly, that's the religious, you know, and mythological foundation that they're working with. So, be aware, brethren, that when it says at the end of verse 4, justice has not allowed him to live, that while in my Bible the J is not capitalized, this may well be referring to the capital J God justice of their time. Okay? And I think it actually is more likely that way. So they were thinking of this as divine retribution, specifically on the hand of that man, because he has to die, since if it's a death penalty, somebody died, and it was his responsibility or fault for it. Well, nothing happens. If you can withstand the bite of this snake, then you're not a murderer. And what's the only other obviously logical conclusion? Why, you must be a god. You kind of got two choices here, you know, in their system. So, now they think he's a god. Well, Paul's had this problem before, so he knows how to deal with that. And all right, you know, not the case. But, to say the least, in verse 7, everyone, including this leading man of the island, and that, by the way, is a Roman position. It's not just that he had success in business or something. Publius is about a Roman name as you could ever hope for. You know, he's the Roman legate, it probably is the official term that he would have had, over this island. So they're going to stay with him for 3 days. Well, it's a big deal. Paul's reputation is well known. The soldiers, you know, have been taking care of him. He's going to tell this Publius about the shipwreck, how he prophesied there wasn't going to be any loss of life. You know, he saved our lives. And so, you know, all this comes to light. Well, Publius has him in. Publius' father is lying afflicted with fever and dysentery. By the way, brethren, you don't see this in the translations again, but Luke is the beloved what? Physician. Okay? This is his bailiwick. This is his home stomping ground. In the original there, actually, it just has the word fever, but it's in the plural. How did they try to bring that across in the translation in the New American Standard? They added a word, if you have the New American. What's the word they added?
Recurrent.
Recurrent is in italics. See, and that's the point. It helps you appreciate why they add those words, and they usually do a good job with it. They admit it's not there, it's just plural, but the idea is he's been suffering for some time, the fevers are coming in cycles, and this island was known for this particular, you know, series of fevers and dysentery because later, they would figure it out, of a microbe that was in the goat milk that was on this particular island. And so this is the thing that they, too, were dealing with, like the snake, you know, just a lot. Well, Paul goes in, and after he prays, he lays his hands on him, and what? What happens to Publius? Dead. Pops out of bed like he's on a pogo stick, I guess. He's healthy as he could be. He's 100% now. Well, this is going to get everybody's attention. So, then verse 9, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. What does the word rest require? The rest of means what?
How many people were sick on that island a few days later? Sorry, go you there. A few days later, after the word gets out, how many are sick? None. Carol's got it. The rest, that everybody else on the island that is sick, who had diseases, are coming to him and getting cured. Now, this is an island, I forget now, I think it's got about 300 or 400 square miles. It's not big, but, you know, it's fairly substantial. And so, I got to be careful about that now. I think I'm giving the figures on Sicily now, and I shouldn't be doing that. Malta's much smaller. But at any rate, however many people they are, the rest of them who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. If you can work miracles by the power of God, how many times will you ever attempt a miracle and fail? Never happen. Anybody who ever claims that they have the power to work miracles, and usually it is healing, in the name of the Lord, and then fails, has conclusively, unarguably demonstrated, proven what? They are not speaking for God. They are not what they claim to be. They are false teachers. Absolutely certain. Never in the Bible is there a single failure in the attempt to heal or to perform any other miracle. In this case, you got a disease-free island when Paul gets done with it. So they stay in 11 for 3 months. And that's because shipping, you know, is closed for the winter now, and it's going to take that long before you get in now to late February, March, so that they can actually be sailing again on the Mediterranean. They set sail on an Alexandrian ship which had wintered at the island and which had the twin brothers for its figurehead. Now, you know, it's not necessary, I guess, but in case you're curious, the twin brothers are Castor, excuse me, and Pollux. And the idea was that one of the gods, Zeus, of course doesn't exist, but Zeus, in their mythology, had fathered a child by a human woman who was married to another guy, by the way. And nonetheless, he violated that marriage, had that child, and, she had twins. The twins are Castor and Pollux. And these two brothers in the mythology had such a perfect fraternal love and respect for each other. The two brothers were the best brothers the world had ever seen in Roman mythology. And since they treated each other so well as brothers, upon their death, Zeus pulled out, you know, their bodies, cast them up into the sky, and made the constellation Castor and Pollux out of them. They became stars. And were then given the power to be the gods of those who have been shipwrecked. So I'm just kind of curious that if the other thing works out like this, these guys, you know, are now on a boat that's been named after Castor and Pollux. Well, that probably got everybody's attention, and no doubt food for a lot of preaching on Paul's part as well. Well, they're continuing to journey. So in verse 12, put in at Syracuse, stayed 3 days. There they sailed around Rhegium. South wind sprang up. Second day, futilely. Found some brethren, invited to stay for 7 days. Thus, we came to Rome. So, saints exist in Italy before and without Paul's being there to establish those congregations. When did Paul write the Roman letter? I gave you the year, showed you in the book where he wrote it. 57 AD. So how long ago was that? 5 years ago. Okay? So 4 to 5 years. And so there's lots of saints that would come the 30 miles from Rome to meet Paul on the way, which was their common way anyway of showing respect to any visiting dignitary. They often did this for their politicians. Now saints are doing it for Paul. 15, I heard him come as far as the Mount of Apias and 3 inches to meet us, and Paul, thank God, and took courage. Of course he did. He had wondering, you know, now I'm a prisoner, how are they going to feel about this? So, he enters Rome in verse 17, 3 days, he calls together the leading men of the Jews. Paul is a powerhouse among the Jews. He is well known by Jews throughout the Roman Empire. And while this last case to get him defeated, you know, hasn't got its people across in the midst of the storm and all that to accuse him yet in Rome, Paul has been setting up dozens and hundreds of congregations for years. So they've heard about this guy, but they don't want to find out, you know, what this is about. So here's this big leader of the Christians, and he says, I have done, verse 17, nothing against our people. Well, that's true. He's done nothing against the customs of the fathers, the Jewish fathers. That's true. I was delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans, and when they examined me, they were going to release me. No reason to put me to death. The Romans know I'm innocent. But when the Jews objected, I was forced to appeal to Caesar, not that I had any accusation against my nation. He said, I've never even laid a charge against these guys who are mistreating me this way. They said, we have neither received letters from Judea concerning you, nor have any of the brethren come here and reported or spoken anything bad about you, but we desire to hear from you what your views are. For concerning this sect, it is known to us, it is spoken against everywhere. Brethren, never forget that as the book of Acts closes, it has been the story of opposition and persecution of every kind and type and degree that can be imagined. And everywhere, Christianity was what? Spoken against and growing like crazy. So, never, ever get discouraged. Well, they said a day came to the lodging in large numbers, and Paul preached a lesson that you've heard before in the book of Acts, verses you know full well from Isaiah chapter 6, and he did the same thing he did everywhere else. This church that is everywhere spoken against, and this man who everywhere has been succeeding anyway, starts off, you know, effectively, in a start off, he's had some that believe and some that won't, ends up there, let's say it that way, probably better, but in these few days, by taking Isaiah 6 and just pointing his finger directly at him. You are those hard-hearted people. You are the ones that close your ears. You are the ones that cover your eyes. That kind of power, that kind of strength, that kind of certainty and confidence, brethren, is often lacking among the saints today now, isn't it? It just is. That kind of blunt, direct, in-your-face sort of a presentation. It's not the way you lead off, but it is the way you end up. If people will not accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, it is not your fault. It is not the gospel's fault. It is their fault. For the truth of this is manifest, brethren, to any honest and open heart. So, some were persuaded in verse 24, others would not, and when they couldn't agree, they're leaving. And Paul said, and we'll close with this, the Holy Spirit rightly spoke through Isaiah the prophet to your fathers, saying, go to this people and say, you will keep on hearing but will not understand. You will keep on seeing but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I should heal them. Let it be known to you, therefore, that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will also listen. But it tears everybody up, and they're arguing, you know, and off. And the book ends with Paul sitting down to spend 2 years in Rome writing some of the most important literature the world will ever see. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. Thanks for your attention. See you about 10.